I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, a hospital in one of the most progressive areas of the country is quietly making changes to its gender care for minors. That after a whistleblower report. We'll discuss, and the whistleblower will join us.
Very emotional to see the letter and to be like, oh my gosh, maybe it mattered. Maybe it counted for something, you know?
Plus, I'm calling it. King County Executive Dow Constantine should resign. It's well past time, and his latest remarks are proof of it. And Kamala Harris's bizarre political ad about her work at the southern border. I thought she wasn't the border czar. Very confusing. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. This is why we do this show. This is why we talk all the time about your commitment to giving common sense a comeback and about the issues that we discuss on this show that aren't being discussed elsewhere in mainstream media. And one of those things that, look, it's a touchy subject. Sometimes we discuss it on the show and we're worried that we're going to get deplatformed, that all the videos we post about it are going to be taken down. But it's sort of like, well, either we talk about it or no one's going to talk about it, or very few are going to talk about it. So we want to start the show today with an exclusive story that we just dropped over on Patreon and Locals. The headline, Washington State Hospital Quietly Reforms Gender Clinic. The move comes after a former therapist blew the whistle in an article in the Free Press. So you will recall, if you're fans of the show, this story very well. We're talking about MultiCare's Mary Bridge Children's Hospital down in Tacoma, where they have a gender clinic. Back in February, a former therapist for MultiCare named Tamara Pitsky came out in a whistleblower report in the Free Press and shared her story about why she quit her job with MultiCare, saying she was told to approve all teen gender transitions, and she refused. And in there, she detailed essentially how she wasn't really given a choice. She was asked to sign a letter sending young patients to the hospital's gender clinic, even if they had other issues that she wanted to dive into as a therapist that might explain why these young people, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, were or thought they were experiencing gender dysphoria. So Tamara Pitsky had published her initial article in the Free Press. At the time, she'd already quit her job with MultiCare. She'd been working as a therapist elsewhere, because of, probably, they never admitted it, but likely because of her report in the Free Press. She was then fired immediately from the new job that she had. So she's been working in private practice ever since. But we had her on the show after her Free Press report was published, and she talked to us about some of these, what I would just call horror stories, of what she saw in this hospital and in the gender clinic. So she would get referred patients, and she was a therapist for all kinds of different patients, adults and kids, some, yes, kids that came there hoping to get a referral for gender hormone therapy, etc. And there was in particular a 13-year-old girl who had been sent to her for therapy, who apparently wanted to, or her dad thought she wanted to transition to become a boy. And so what they were looking for was a signature from Tamara Pitsky to send this 13-year-old to the gender clinic. And as Tamara discussed on our show back in February, there were a whole host of issues that this young girl was dealing with that needed to be addressed before she underwent some sort of life-altering gender changes. Here's a clip.
Extensive trauma history told me that there are times when she'll age regress, that's the phrase she used, where she'll sit and watch Teletubbies for hours and suck on a pacifier. And when I asked her about her upcoming gender clinic appointment, she didn't even know she had one. So here we are trying to get a letter for this child to start testosterone, and there's all these other things at play.
When you say she had some trauma, there's some pretty serious family trauma there.
Her mom tried to kill her sister. All that she was exposed to as far as movies growing up were porn and horror. Like, that's all they had at their house.
Her mom engaged in bestiality.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we're talking about some serious stuff that any child who, if exposed to that,
would have some issues.
Have issues to work through. Yeah. And so Tamara Pitsky, as a therapist who cares about the well-being of her patients, she said, you know, she needs help, you know, she needs more therapy. She needs to have, you know, discuss these things that have happened in her past and her trauma. I'm not just going to sign a letter saying, yeah, go get her testosterone therapy. But she said the dictate from MultiCare and what she was told is you are just expected to sign off. You're not expected to question a child's gender preference or gender identity. And so that's when she quit and said enough is enough and blew the whistle on it. So that was in February. This week, we obtained exclusively a letter that the CEO of MultiCare, Bill Robertson, sent out to the hospital's board of directors. It was sent on July 17th, and it outlines changes that the hospital is going to be making to the gender care that they provide youth. Now, I think it's pretty obvious that the changes spelled out in this letter are a result of Tamara Pitsky, of some of the things that she talked about in her free press reporting, of some of the things that she blew the whistle about. We've reached out to MultiCare for them to explain the genesis of this letter and why they've decided to change course. But I think it is pretty clear, and I'll read a portion of this letter, that they have now been convinced to take a more thoughtful approach to the gender care that kids receive. They said they spent the last year doing an extensive review of the best available information on gender care for kids. It says, as a result of our review and based on the best clinical evidence available today, we will enhance our holistic approach to gender-affirming healthcare for adolescents. Backed by the most up-to-date science, we believe this enhanced approach will provide the best and safest course of treatment for our young patients. Our new integrated multidisciplinary team we've created to support adolescents seeking gender healthcare includes experts in behavioral health, endocrinology, adolescent medicine, and social work. This team will take a judicious approach to providing care and will work collaboratively with families to support their needs. As part of our efforts to adhere to the best practice approaches we've identified as being necessary, we now require all patients referred from outside providers to be evaluated by the Mary Bridge Children's multidisciplinary team prior to being accepted for care. Mary Bridge Children's does not provide gender-affirming surgeries. So this letter is cautious, but I think the point of it is clear, is that whether they felt pressure to do this or whether they truly reevaluated the best available science, MultiCare has decided and is telling its board of directors that they are going to take a more holistic approach when youth come to them seeking gender care, and that it will no longer be simply an expectation that therapists sign a letter saying just send them to the gender clinic, and that is the first course of treatment. And to me, and we're going to bring on Tamara Pitsky here in a moment to discuss this, because she is reacting now to this letter that we showed her for the first time. You know, I think the letter reads very diplomatically, right? But I think you also have to consider the state that we're in. In Washington state, it is one of the most progressive states in the nation. We have lawmakers who routinely are trying to push through legislation to strengthen the ability of kids, you know, as young as 12 and 13 to be able to get gender care, sometimes without the consent of their parents. So in this political environment in the state of Washington, MultiCare doing this is going to be met with, I think, a fair share of criticism from the left. And certainly they know that when they take when they're taking these steps. So I have to believe that they are convinced these are the right steps to take. I think it's tremendously consequential. Of course, I wanted to ask Tamara Pitsky what she thinks. I got in touch with her yesterday. I shared the letter with her. She was nice enough to join us today to offer her reactions. Tamara, welcome back to Undivided.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Yeah, so you have the letter that we have. Your yes. initial reaction on seeing that they are making some changes?
I'm very grateful to know that that my voice is counted in some small capacity, that they are reportedly looking into the different research that's being put out there, and that they're wanting to do what's best for their clients. I think that that's incredibly encouraging.
Yeah. I think reading this with your lens of having been there and knowing how things work, explain to us kind of what the big changes are that you see, because they talk about this more holistic approach, which seems to speak to a chief concern that you brought up in your whistleblower report, which is like you were just told, like, sign off and send them to the gender clinic. And they're saying, you know, we want to first kind of surround them with these other professionals. So can you talk about reading that, whether you see that as a change that was brought about by some of your concerns?
I don't know. I hope so. I hope that my voice counted for something. I'm a little bit confused in the letter just because it's not super clear. So I feel like, okay, but we've had those people in place before. So how are they going to be taking on a different role, you know, where we're not just fast tracking people? But I'm glad that it sounds like they're genuinely wanting to look at it from all the different angles.
But what do you make of them saying that they've been doing this review of their youth gender care for a year since last fall?
It's hard for me to understand how that could be true, since they had the mandatory gender affirming care training in the fall, where I was met with so much hostility for raising any questions or concerns. But if that's true, if they have been looking into it since then, then it didn't trickle down to any of the supervisors or anyone else in mental health.
Yeah, it would kind of seem weird that up top, they're like, let's reevaluate this. But at your level, they're like, you'll just do it. You know, like there wasn't sort of this communication. Like you knew something might be off, but you still were, you know, forcing people like Tamara to do this.
Yeah, exactly. Like they were like, I want to make it very clear that this is MultiCare's, you know, best practice. We won't tolerate anything less. And so it's hard for me to understand, like, okay, so you guys are doing that research.
But I look at the letter in its totality and through the political environment that we're in here. Like, this is one of the most progressive places in the country. We have lawmakers routinely pushing through protections for this kind of care, you know, pushing away parents from being involved in this kind of care. It seems like this would be a difficult letter, politically speaking, for MultiCare to even write.
Absolutely. I have so much respect for the fact that they're willing to even like to make any changes at all, because I think this, I mean, I know I, as an individual, was met with the hostility I was met with. I can only imagine the level of like concern that they have as to how this is going to be received by people.
Yeah. So I mean, I get, you know, some of the concerns about, yeah, this is a little like tepid, right? But, and then at the same time, the political reporter in me is like, but is it? Because I feel like there's going to be some backlash for them from certain segments of the community that they would entertain the idea of reforming the gender clinic. If they're serious about it and they're serious about taking these steps and making sure that they're not just signing off and sending kids to get life-altering care, what do you think the implications of that could be more broadly?
I'm hoping that we're starting to make the world, or at least our area of the world, a little safer for kids. You know, I think kids are so, so confused and so lost. And it's our job as adults to guide them, you know, and it's unfair, I think, to create an environment where medical professionals aren't allowed to use to exercise critical thinking, and where they're telling parents like, hey, if we don't do this thing, your kid's going to die. Like, that's just not what the evidence is showing. And so we need to be able to create an environment where, like MultiCare's letter said, that it's more holistic, where we're like, you know, yeah, this is absolutely causing your kid's suffering, but let's not just, you know, start them on hormone therapy. So I'm really hopeful that we're going to start making the world a little safer for them.
If that is the direction that they are truly going, does that make everything you lost worth it for you?
It would be worth it regardless. Absolutely. It makes me feel like a huge immense, like, just relief. But yes, it's worth it because I stood up for my values and I did what I felt like was necessary. And, you know, I think that it's worth it because I was true to myself and I gave a voice to these kids and these parents. But yes, it's like very emotional to see the letter and to be like, oh my gosh, maybe it mattered. Maybe it counted for something, you know?
Yeah. Well, it did matter. And I've told you that behind the scenes too. You know, the second you decided to say something, it mattered. And I think it started an important conversation. Would you go back to work there?
No.
No. Even if they welcomed you back? Because it's kind of like, man, you know, if they're all now all of a sudden like, Tamara was right, what if they want you to come back and work?
I don't think they're going to go that far as to bring me into it again and apologize.
Yeah. Well, last time we spoke, you were maybe, you know, venturing on your own to do a private practice. Mm-hmm. How has that been going?
It's going well. It's really been a positive change in my life, getting to do good work in the way that I see it, and just meet people where they're at and make sure that I'm creating an environment where like people feel heard and seen and safe. And when I see kids struggling with their gender, to know that like, okay, I'm not going to try to talk them out of anything, but I know that like they have time to figure this out. There's not anyone pushing me to medicalize them, you know?
Yeah, are you, how are you finding patients, clients?
People see me on different podcasts or reach out to me through like Psychology Today. I have a website, so yeah, people have been reaching out for through a variety of different ways.
And you're seeing youth and adults.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, give us your website, Tamara.
It's Pitsky. I don't know if my name is going to be
We'll put
somewhere.
it
It's a
up.
tricky one.
We'll put it up.
Okay. Pitskycounseling.com.
Gotcha. Well, I think that's awesome. And I think for anyone who
Yeah.
actually wants some like genuinely care, someone who cares and wants to get to the bottom of what's going on, whether it's for themselves or their kids, that's great. I'm just, again, I'm just so like proud to know you and proud to have sort of
Yeah.
followed you on this crazy situation. And hopefully this is the beginning of something really, really meaningful in terms of the change of gender care. Because if it can happen in, Washington State, where
I
people take a
know.
second look, then I think it can happen anywhere.
I would agree with that, absolutely.
All right, Tamara. Well, I think we'll talk again, okay?
Okay, thank you so much.
Again, that's Tamara Pitsky, the multi-care whistleblower, and I think now we're seeing the fruits of what she did at tremendous, I think, personal risk. This is not the end by any means. When I read this letter and think about, all the care being pushed on youth, I think there's a lot more that can be done. We have reached out to MultiCare this morning with a long list of questions, trying to get clarity on some of the things in the letter. We also want to know, does this apply across the MultiCare system? Is this specific to the gender clinic at Mary Bridge? And to answer, to ask some of the questions Tamara had about it when she looked at it. If they were, for instance, reevaluating based on new medical information for the last year, whether they were providing the right kind of gender care for kids, doesn't that suggest that they were sort of hesitant to begin with or had questions to begin with? So, did they embark on these efforts to provide this gender care for countless patients and then pull back, as opposed to vice versa, and say, hey, let's study this first, make sure that we really know that what we're doing is what we should be doing, and then we'll do a gender clinic. So it seems like there's a little bit of a cart before the horse situation. But I think significant news to have something like this coming out of Washington State, just outside of Seattle, a very, very progressive area in a state where politicians are constantly pushing to increase access for gender care for youth. And now one major hospital is saying, not so fast. The significance of that cannot be understated. So this is not the last that we're going to talk about this, and we'll update the story when and if we hear back from MultiCare with answers to our questions. All right, coming up next, I think it's time for King County Executive Dow Constantine to resign. 15 years is long enough, and he has shown that he is completely incapable of acknowledging the impact that his leadership or lack thereof has had on our crime crisis. I'll dive into that first. I have encouraged you guys to take the First Mark challenge. I've been talking about First Mark for about a year on the show now. I get my insurance through First Mark, so does Nicole. Undivided is insured through First Mark, and that's because First Mark offers a superior service, and you never pay them for it, so that really helps. What the First Mark challenge entails is scheduling some time with First Mark. You could do it over the phone, talking to them about your current insurance, any concerns you have about your insurance and your insurance needs. They take that information. They go out for free. They shop their a bevy of carriers for you, and they come back with recommendations. We get testimonials from you guys all the time who have taken the First Mark challenge and ended up saving money. And sometimes, though, that's not the case. Sometimes First Mark comes back and says, hey, we can't save you money. Or the insurance you have is just fine, or tell it gives you more information about the state of the market. We got this message from Nita today. Says, finally got around to contacting First Mark. I was contacted the next day, and the conversation was incredibly helpful. The representative advised me not to cancel my current insurance because no one is insuring Kias and Hyundais anymore, so I would be left without coverage for one of my vehicles. She said it was shocking to learn that. I'm so glad he contacted me quickly so I could pay the current premium to keep my coverage. Good thing she didn't let it lapse, and that that they got back to her so fast. She said, I appreciated the chit-chat and casualness, answering my questions, receiving confirmation that my rate is about what he would expect, and clarification on options for adding my team to my policy versus getting him his own policy was extremely helpful. So in this case, she did the first mark challenge, was able to avoid disaster by losing insurance on one of her cars altogether, and just got a little bit of information from them. It doesn't sound like she's going to become a member of the First Mark family, but that's the beauty of the First Mark challenge. These people are just so dang honest. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com, they work for you. Dow Constantine, you got to go. I'm not going to call for you to be recalled or something. That's just Senator Mark Olias. That's the only one I think should be recalled right now. I digress. Dow Constantine just needs to go. I don't know what he's doing. He's not running for governor, thankfully, but the King County executive has been an utter failure. He's on his fourth term in office, and he's just the poster child for no self-awareness. You know, if you're the leader of a place for 16 years and all the big issues have gotten worse, like, don't you look in a mirror and think, like, maybe this is me. Maybe we just need someone with new ideas, with better ideas. I'll start this segment by talking about this funny comic Change Washington put out this morning. Did you see it, Nicole? Mm-hmm. They're very good at comics. That's a spitting image of Dow Constantine.
It's really good.
It is. It says, Dow Constantine hears no evil, sees no evil, speaks nonsense. 100%. I mean, he came out, he said drugs have nothing to do with the homeless problem. And then he's, you know, oh, failing to enforce laws doesn't affect crime. It's like, no, it does. So the latest ordeal with Dow Constantine has to do with the King County Jail. Remember, this is a guy who, you know, got all woke in 2020 and said, we're going to end juvenile detention. And that hasn't happened because, of course, we have a lot of juvenile crime. And so he wanted to get bonus points by promising to do something that just wasn't feasible. But this is someone who's been very soft on crime. And there's an issue right now at the King County Jail, the main adult juvenile or main adult detention facility for King County, right in downtown Seattle. It's had a couple issues. So they stopped taking a lot of bookings during the pandemic, and we were led to believe, oh, it's just a pandemic thing. But now they have a shortage of guards. So there's a lot of bookings, as we know, that they're just flat out turning away. So remember, unless the entire system is working, it's going to continue to be a failure. So you have a Seattle city attorney who I think is more tough on crime, certainly than previous city attorneys in Ann Davison, and she wants to book criminals. She wants police officers who arrest criminals to be able to freaking book those criminals in the King County Jail. And not only does she want that, she expects that. Well, why does she expect that? Well, because the city of Seattle pays King County for the pleasure of using their jail. The city of Seattle pays King County for access to about 200 beds within the King County Jail. Yet still, Seattle police officers come in, they try to book criminals on misdemeanor crimes that are wreaking havoc on the city, and they're turned away. And Ann Davison, she was in front of the Seattle City Council. This was a clip from last week. And she says, you want to know why crime is so bad and why we've got repeat offenders who are out time and time again, why we've got someone who is just smoking fentanyl on the street corner and he's back out 3 hours later? Well, it's because we can't book them in jail. Here's a clip.
Is our Seattle police officers that we've heard about are not able to book on over half of our misdemeanor crimes that are listed in our city's laws. So I'd like to say that staggering sentence again. Our officers are not able to book on over half of the misdemeanor crimes that are listed in our city's laws. And so when you are looking at what can your limited number of officers that we have with the struggles of recruiting that Chief Rahr has identified, we need to be able to provide something for them so they know that they can be responsive in the moment to community.
Yeah, so they can book on, there's some exceptions, assault, DUI, sex crimes, domestic violence, those are going to be booked. But as she mentioned, half of the laws that fall within the purview of the Seattle City Attorney's Office, which handles misdemeanors, the King County Sheriff's Office, Prosecutor's Office, they're going to handle felony stuff. It is theft, property destruction, animal cruelty, trespassing, and a whole lot more. The drug crimes that we have that they're trying to enforce, arresting people on, all these emphasis patrols and all of that. So you've got half of the laws that are the city attorney wants to prosecute and has the political will to prosecute. And we can certainly move forward with that case. Just because someone's not booked into jail doesn't mean you can't prosecute him. But good luck finding the guy who was on 3rd and Pine, you know, doing fentanyl and had just got arrested for the 8th time. Now you're going to throw the book at him and try to force him into treatment. You think you're going to find him again to prosecute that case? Of course you're not. So if he has to go before a judge and there's some bail set and there's some conditions of release, you know, maybe there's a chance. So she's frustrated, right? She has every reason to be frustrated. She has every right to be frustrated, but Dow Constantine doesn't think so. And Dow Constantine is just personally offended that Ann Davison is blaming King County and the jail. In the Seattle Times, the headline, County Executive Blames Seattle City Attorney, Not the Jail, for Safety Issues. It says, in a message to Metropolitan King County Council members sent by Penny Lipsow, Director of Council Relations, Constantine said Davison's claims are misguided. The jail makes exceptions to booking restrictions when there is a compelling reason, the message said, and Davison's office has simply been ineffective at making those arguments in court. The message said, quote, rather than attacking the jail, she should first get her own shop in order. The message goes on to invite, how passive aggressive is this? The message goes on to invite Seattle to cancel its contract with the county for jail space. Quote, the county is more than willing to immediately release the city from any further obligations under the 2012 contract. This would ameliorate the jail's staffing challenges and allow the county to focus on the more serious felony suspects and offenders who are the county's responsibility under state law. How petty, small, temper tantrum-y is that? Ann Davison brings up a factual point. I'm the city attorney, and I want you to know that we cannot book about half of the people being arrested, that there isn't space in the jail, space that we pay for, to book criminals who we want to book. And she has every right to bring that up. And Dow Constantine, in his fourth term, he throws a temper tantrum, ends up in the Seattle Times. But I would also just point out, when they say, oh, well, then fine, the city of Seattle can just cancel its contracts altogether and save us the time and the energy and not bring any of their suspects here. When they say that it would ameliorate the staffing challenges, so if Seattle PD wasn't booking misdemeanors into the jail, they said, okay, that'll help with their staffing challenges. But then they say it will allow the county to focus on the more serious felony suspects and offenders. Do they not realize that the people who are committing all these misdemeanor crimes over and over and over again, those are the people who are going to pick up a gun in downtown and shoot a random tourist tomorrow. Those are the people who are, you know, high out of their minds, stabbing people on the light rail station. Like, today's repeat misdemeanor offenders, particularly in downtown Seattle, are tomorrow's felony offenders. How many times have we seen that? We've seen that over and over and over again. People who are booked, you know, 78 times, there's that one guy, throws coffee on a baby. Other instances where you've got the guy who killed a person with rebar. There were all these instances that there could have been intervention previously. We should want predominantly the people being booked into jail to be misdemeanor offenders because we're having an intervention before they commit a serious violent felony crime. So Dow Constantine should resign. Dow, I'm serious about it. Like, look, you've put 15 years in. Crime is worse. Affordability is worse. Homelessness is worse. The drug crisis is worse. Spending is higher than it's ever been. Taxes are higher than they've ever been. And we are getting absolutely nothing for it. You have done nothing for the county. Genuinely, you have done nothing for the county. And after 15 years, maybe you can take a break and go do other things. I think it is time for him to resign. You have no self-awareness. You have no accountability. You don't care that people are dying in the streets with a needle in their arm. You don't care that there's still a massive homelessness problem. And you don't care about crime. You genuinely don't. You care about FaceTime on TV, maybe trying to run for governor in 8 years after your buddy Bob Ferguson does. But what I know for sure is you actually don't care about the issues that are your responsibility in King County. So it's time for you to go. Speaking of crime, I want to talk again today about juvenile offenders. An update on a story we discussed last week. So there was a parade over the weekend where three teens were armed to the hilt with I guess they're made to be automatic weapons. Like it was a weapon that they had some sort of thing on that made it automatic, but at a parade. And one of the scary things about it was that, so these are like young juveniles, and the people who noticed them, like, you know, gang banging around and having these guns on them, were the family members in the parade of a teen who'd just been killed. and they were marching in the parade to honor that teen's life when they saw these three juveniles who they believe are connected to his murder, and they told police, like, go get them, they're armed, they're all these things. So, I mean, really horrifying situation. So we talked about it earlier this week because one of the teens got released on house arrest, which I just thought was insane. Well, now all three of them are back home. This was the Chinatown Seafair Parade where all this happened. All three of these teens have been released to electronic home monitoring. Think about that for a second. They brought loaded guns, one of them equipped to be fully automatic, to a busy parade in downtown Seattle. Frankly, I said it on the show the other day. Can you imagine this was a lone white gunman who had the exact same types of firearms? You think that that gunman would be home on electronic home monitoring? No, but black youth, it's like, oh, okay, no big deal. Send him home. It says the three teens accused of setting off mass panic at the Chinatown Seafair Parade last week are now all back home after a judge released them onto electronic home monitoring. All three were arrested with loaded guns, and police say two of those guns had been modified with a Glock switch, oh, two of them, to become fully automatic. So a couple things I want to talk about here. This is actually interesting because remember on, was it Monday's show or Tuesday's show, we had the prosecutor on.
Was it? Yes, Monday.
Monday's show. Mm-hmm. We had on a King County prosecutor to talk about juvenile crime. Her name is Jamie Kvistad. Remember, we talked about efforts to like keep gang activity and juvenile crime from bleeding into our schools. I brought up to her just offhand how it doesn't seem like there's consequences for juvenile offenders. And I mentioned this exact case at the time that one of these kids had been allowed to go home on electronic home monitoring. I didn't realize she's the prosecutor on this case. And she was in court essentially begging the judge not to allow it. I don't know if she just didn't bring that up because the interview was unrelated, but I'm sure she was thinking, like, should I mention that I'm the prosecutor on that case? So according to Como News, King County prosecutors, the prosecutor we spoke to on the show on Monday, argued in court against the teens' release for the community's safety, but the judge stated she wanted to see if these teens could turn things around with the community support programs and interventions put in place to keep them on track.
I was banging on the door, shouting inappropriate comments towards the staff and making threats. This happened literally the night before his detention review when he comes before this court today to ask for release.
We've detained people for years. And crime is still here. Children are still committing inappropriate things. We still have behaviors that are concerning. This is going to take a lot more than just throwing people in and locking them up without a key. You invited me into your life by engaging in the behavior you're engaged in. That simple. So if you want us out of your life, what do you have to do?
Try not to come back here.
Not just try. You got to succeed.
Insane. She also said, you're not going to hold this child for the rest of his life, so let's stop pretending holding people here is going to solve and resolve these issues. I mean, almost scolding. She goes on to kind of, I mean, she doesn't even, she scolded the prosecutor more than she scolded the teen. Like, you've invited me into your life, so what do you have to do? Like, a teen that brought a fully automatic gun to a parade. You got to not come back here. And meanwhile, she's like scolding the prosecutor for like, how dare you suggest that this teen shouldn't be released on house arrest?
We've detained people for years. And crime is still here. Children are still committing inappropriate things. We still have behaviors that are concerning. This is going to take a lot more than just throwing people in and locking them up without a key.
So that's fine, but you have to do those things while you hold people accountable for their behavior. So you're suggesting, oh, so like this one judge believes that she's like, oh, we have to reform the entire system. So in the meantime, while the system's being reformed, I'll just let them go home. Like, no, like I don't disagree that we have a lot of juvenile crime. So clearly there's a breakdown in some areas, but that doesn't mean you just don't do your job. That doesn't mean you just let all the juveniles who bring loaded weapons to parades or who shoot people or who commit drive-bys, well, just let them go home because, you know, we've had juveniles who've been held for years and they still commit crime. That's insane. That's someone who, frankly, does not belong on the bench. Mm-hmm. I hate to say that. I really try to, with jurists, be respectful, but that's those are insane statements, truly.
She has a record of this, and I know that we've done some research on, or some outing of her in the past on Dory's show, and I would like to do something bigger about some of these cases and kind of keep an eye on her. And the other thing is that she said that they are allowed to leave their homes to play football, to practice football and to, I think, go to church. But I'm like, okay, so you think this kid that's banging on doors or whatever, or, you know, flashing guns that are made automatic, that's a safe kid to put with kids that are trying to play football? And because I'm sure he's going to take you up on that. That's a free right. out. Now you're exposing other kids who are just trying to play football to this kid. Now, I don't think he shouldn't be allowed to play football, mm-hmm. but come on. This is insane.
You definitely have to. I mean, this is a kid who's obviously like deep into gang life and gang right. activity. And if I don't know if that family is correct, mm-hmm. but the family suspects that those teens were all involved in the murder of their son.
Right.
So like I do, we talk about this on the show all the time. I want kids in school. I want them in athletics and doing all these other things. But we also have to protect the kids who are doing the right things from, you know, potentially very dangerous young people.
We couldn't show up late to class or get a bad grade and be allowed to play sport. So I'm not sure how you can be a suspect or maybe a questionable whatever and go to jail and then be allowed to play sports.
That's a insane. Very good point. That's a very good point. I'm curious if any of you coach football or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Like if a kid has bad grades or something, I'm sure they're ineligible.
Practice.
And so are you not ineligible if you bring a fully automatic weapon to a parade? Does that not make you ineligible to play football? I'm all for, you know, do what you have to do, pay, you know, the price for what you've already done mm-hmm. and the crime you've committed. And then, you know, we need to get you back on track. And maybe there is a day where it's safe for you to go play football and try to turn your life around.
Earn
but
it.
This judge, that's insane. So yeah, we'll have to look into other things mm-hmm. that she's done because her name did sound familiar to you as soon as you saw the story. So the judge mentioned, you know, going to church is one of the things that these teens can do while they're sitting at home on house arrest. There is a young boy, 13-year-old Matthew Stefkovi, who will never get to go to church again. Church was a favorite activity of his, and now he's dead, and he's lost his life because of this juvenile crime crisis that we're in. And this is a young boy, I think, different from a lot of the stories that we discuss. He had no involvement in criminal activity. He is, in every sense of the word, an innocent victim. And this is not the first such case. We talked about the young woman, 13 years old as well, who was shot to death at the mall because there was a fight between a group of kids that she wasn't involved in. And one of the kids pulled out a gun, tried to shoot at the other group, and she was hit with a bullet and she died. She lost her life at a mall. So Matthew, again, this 13-year-old, he was killed in Kent on July 16th. So the background of it, apparently a friend had arranged to meet someone to sell a camera on OfferUp. So Matt was with his sister. They were on their ATV. They, you know, ran into their friend and said, hey, we'll come with you. No big deal. So they all go to sell this camera. And then they realize they're being robbed. And Matthew and his sister try to run back to their ATV. And Matthew got shot in the back as he was trying to run back to the ATV. And he eventually died. I wanted to read you just a little bit from the court documents and all of the suspects. When this happened, were teenagers. One of them just turned 20 years old, but when the crime happened, was 19 years old. God, this is so sad. And it's terrifying. It's like, this poor kid. So they use initials for all of these juveniles, obviously, so the court documents get a little bit hard to wade through. But it says, the kid who went to sell the camera was on his way to Turnkey Park, ran into his acquaintances, Matt and his sister. They decided to go with. All four juveniles traveled together to the park. As the one kid was negotiating payment with someone called Zed for the camera and a second black male, that's when he saw a third black male dressed in black clothing and wearing a face mask come out of the park and pull a pistol from his sweatshirt. He was pushed to the ground and his camera equipment, which was in a silver case and backpack, were forcefully removed from him. And that's when he heard 3 to 4 gunshots and he ran to hide. He told the police that after seeing the mass, and this is Matthew's sister, she told the police that after seeing the mass subject produce the gun, she and her brother Matt turned and ran toward their ATV with the intentions of fleeing the area. Once they arrived at the ATV, they began the process of mounting it and at the same time heard at least one gunshot come from behind them. Matt got on the ATV and as he was driving, his sister seated behind him, he told his sister he thought he'd been shot. They kept driving on the ATV and even as they were fleeing the robbery, even after shots had been fired, they saw three suspects following behind them. Shortly after leaving the park, Matt lost consciousness. His sister took over driving. She drove to an apartment complex where she flagged people down. They called 911, but it was too late, and Matt was already dead. The 14 suspects are being held on $2 million bail. They're being charged with first-degree murder, first-degree robbery, all with gun enhancements. You know, this is one of the things we talk a lot about with juvenile crime. When I hear a judge like that say, you know, holding them doesn't do anything, and, you know, we need them to be out of the system and all of that. When you don't hold them accountable for lesser crimes, you have told them that it's okay to live the life that they're living. And that's when it elevates to crimes like this, where they actually use those guns that they have. They use those guns to kill people. And oftentimes when juveniles use guns to commit an act of violence, they're using those guns against other juveniles, like in this case, a 13-year-old, or like in the case of Jada, who was 13 years old when she was killed at the mall. So judges like this judge, Veronica Galvin, by trying to take it easy on juvenile offenders, you're putting other juveniles' lives at risk. And you are making it much more likely that those juveniles who appear in court in front of you will go on to commit more serious crimes that you can't just sweep under the rug, that you can't send them home on electronic home monitoring for. They're going to kill someone unless you teach them early on that there are consequences for their actions. You know, I mentioned church earlier, that judge saying, oh, this, you know, 13-year-old suspect who brought a gun to the parade, they can go home on electronic home monitoring, they can, you know, play football, and they can go to church, but that's about it. You know, I am sure that the family of Matthew Stefkovic wishes he could go to church again. There's a clip going around online of him speaking at church. I want to play that for you.
The role of the father reminds us of the love and compassion that our father has for us. And in Matthew 12:30, it says, and let's let God be present in our daily lives, and let's check ourselves if we're allowing worldly choices into our lives. And if we are, today's the day for repentance, because God is our loving father. Amen.
Rest in peace, Matthew. You deserved much better than that. Our society has failed you. Our criminal justice system has failed you. The people who have been in power in this state for 40 years have failed you. And judges like that judge, I'm going to say her name again, Veronica Galvin, have failed kids like you. And unfortunately, there will be many other kids like you if something does not change. My heart breaks for Matthew's family. Horrible. All right, I want to do a follow-up to a story we started the show with yesterday. So I told you guys that if you qualify, you're going to start getting either emails or a letter in the mail from PSU alerting you to a $200 credit that you're going to get on your PSE bill. And before you get too excited, reminder, that's your own money that they're giving back to you, that they took from you through the Climate Commitment Act. Governor Jay Inslee's precious Climate Commitment Act, which will be on the ballot in November. And if you vote yes on Initiative 2117 to repeal the CCA, the amount of money that you will save repealing the CCA will make the $200 credit, the bribe that they're trying to give you before the election, look just like pennies, like nothing. So don't let the bribe distract you from the bigger picture. Governor Jay Inslee has lied about the CCA. He claimed it wouldn't raise gas prices, it wouldn't raise energy prices, and as a result, food prices. It did. He knows that. When he was caught red-handed, he blamed it on pipeline maintenance. That's why gas prices are going up. When people didn't buy that, what did he blame it on? The greed of the gas and oil companies. When people didn't buy that, he said, well, repealing it via initiative might not lower gas prices anyway. And when it became clear that no one was buying this, that the initiative to repeal the CCA is incredibly popular among Republicans, independents, and Democrats alike, the governor trotted out a $200 bribe, just hoping that he would convince enough voters, if you don't repeal the CCA, we're going to keep the money coming, even though they have made no plans to give you anything other than a one-time $200 credit on your energy bills just before the November election. Do not fall for it. So after this came out yesterday, we, of course, had to get in touch with our friend Todd Myers at the Washington Policy Center, who specializes in climate-related issues. There were a couple issues on the docket we wanted to discuss, but of course we had to start with this conversation about what is, make no mistake, a bribe. Let's just look at it by the numbers. So if you've got some of these households getting a $200 credit, does that make up for the costs that they've incurred as part of the Climate Commitment Act?
Well, first off, you know, there was no talk of even doing rebates until Initiative 2117 was on the ballot. So the fact that he's doing these all of a sudden in an election year, clearly it's what's intended. He's intended to try to influence people's vote. But the question is, okay, so $200, what does that get you? Well, based on the average amount of natural gas people use and the average amount of gasoline people use, for a two-car family, average family, they paid last year about $631
extra
just because of the CO2 tax. Now, okay, that's an average, but let's say low income. Low income with one car and paying about 60%, using about 60% of natural gas, they paid $333. So $200 doesn't even come close to covering the additional costs that people paid in 2023. And of course, all the projections are that prices will go up next year. They've gone down a little bit this year because the initiative is on the ballot. But if the initiative fails and we keep it, prices will go up beyond what they were in 2023.
And there's no indication that these credits are going to be some sort of like yearly thing.
No, in fact, the budget for the money from this tax has been budgeted out many years in some cases. In some cases, it's shorter term, but in many cases, it's out. This is a one-year thing. There is no plan for next year to give these sorts of credits or rebates. You know, in the past, I actually supported a revenue neutral approach where you would take the money and you would rebate it back. The governor rejected that. So it's clearly he's doing this in an election year ploy.
Have you seen the clip of him with Chris Daniels?
I have not.
Well, you should watch it. I'll tell you, I watched it and I'm just more pissed off than ever about it. He has the audacity after the lies that he told, you know, promising people for years it wouldn't increase gas prices when that didn't work, you know, blaming gas and oil companies. Now he is saying that it is greedy and horrible, like unconscionable, for people who support the initiative to repeal the CCA to want to take away these $200 credits from working class families.
Well, he should have told himself that last year, because he didn't even offer these last year. He's only offered them this year. And he should have made sure that they would continue in the future. He's the one taking them away. So, I mean, look in the mirror first. But, you know, the notion that you're greedy because you're paying $600 extra a year, but you're not going to, you know, give $200 back. It's, I mean, there's a term for this. It's called bribing people with their own money. And I think people are smart enough to see through it.
What do you think it is for Inslee? Just, I know you're not like super into being partisan, but humor me. I mean, is this his genuine concern for the environment? Is it a concern for his legacy, for his future career prospects once he leaves the governor's office? What do you think is driving that level of, frankly, dishonesty?
You know, people often say follow the money. I don't like that, because a lot of people do things in politics, public policy, where they make less money or where the money would be better. People, from time to time, people accuse me of taking the money. And I tell them, being a conservative environmentalist in Washington state is about the dumbest way to make money that you could think of. So I don't believe this is about money. I don't think it's about future job prospects. I think he truly believes this. I think he believes he's doing the right thing. But I also think that politicians, right, they want to feel good about themselves. And so once your self-image, once your sense of self-worth is wrapped up in something, then, you know, really all bets are off in terms of the rhetoric and commitment and things like that. And I just think he wants to be a climate crusader. That's how he sees himself. And by God, he's going to do what he needs to do to be a climate crusader.
Well, let's talk about this climate crusade and who it's really helping and who it's really hurting. You know, there have been a couple headlines, one of them out of the city of Seattle, where they're basically saying, like, look, you know, the projections for usage of electricity as the state pushes this electrification, you know, they're far outpacing our expectations. We might not have the supply. So they're warning that there's going to be an uptick in energy rates. That can't come as a surprise to you.
No, it's that's the intent, right? Again, it's not, people say, well, may or may not increase energy rates or gas or whatever else. No, that's the intent. They're trying to get people off of fossil fuels. So of course that's going to happen.
Well, you also were mentioning to me before we started, you know, when we look at people getting hit hard, I mean, I really think that a lot of the climate policy has been pushed on the backs of the working class, like what you're seeing with the CCA and at the gas pump and, you know, for City Light customers who are going to see their electric rates start to go up. You were mentioning, too, with electric vehicles, you know, it's like, well, go out and buy an electric vehicle. Well, I can't. They're expensive. OK, we'll give you a subsidy. But you've sort of tracked where some of those subsidies are going.
Well, right. So the legislature has their own auditing agency called JLARC, and they just put out a report looking at what they call alternative fuel vehicles, which is essentially electric vehicles. And what they found is that 70% of the subsidies go to census tracts where people make more than average. Well, that shouldn't surprise. I mean, we've done our own analysis in the past and found that it's, you know, very high percentage of the subsidies are going to wealthy people because that's who can afford these cars. And even when they say, oh, well, here we have subsidies for lower income people. Well, lower income people can't buy even a Nissan Leaf because the Nissan Leaf is so much more expensive than the gas powered alternative. So it shouldn't surprise us. Yeah. Energy costs are regressive. They are harder. Low income people have a harder time avoiding energy costs than high income people. And then we turn around, use the taxes that they pay and subsidize the wealthy. It's really a bad situation. And it just shows how, I think, disingenuous a lot of the talk about, you know, lack of equity and concern about inequality is, because when they want something, they ignore all of that. And they will tax the poor and subsidize the rich, as they're doing with this case.
Yeah. So here you have, you know, working class people. They're really being stuck with the price tag of all of this. And then they're supposed to be grateful when they get a few dollars given back to them of their own money. And then there was this article that came out that just seems like it's like, oh, you're expected to follow my climate agenda and all of that, no, even if it is breaking your budget. And then there's this news of Inslee vetoing a study about how these big data centers, how much power they're using. So it seems weird that Inslee would veto a study about power usage. So can you explain to me why this is a big deal?
Well, I mean, it's a big deal for a whole range of reasons. One, the governor has also vetoed studies in the past on looking at total electricity demand in the future to try to figure out how we're going to accommodate, you know, electric vehicles and heat pumps and all these things. And now data centers, which are run by Microsoft and Google and Amazon, right? I mean, so I just think it shows the corruption of the system. I don't like to say that, but it really is corrupt when you have the people who get the preferences are the people who have the lobbyists. And the people who don't have the lobbyists, they're the ones who pay the prices. And this is a perfect example of where if you have good lobbyists, you can say, no, don't look at this. The governor knows that data centers use a lot of electricity. I don't have a problem with that. I think, right, that's great. We want Microsoft. We want Amazon to succeed. We want all these folks to succeed. But simply saying we're not even going to look at that is just shows that this is more about politics than actually trying to do what's best for the environment and dealing with the stresses. And the reality is we can't ignore the problem. We have to supply that electricity. And if we don't think about it and plan for it, it's going to drive costs up and it's going to increase the risk of blackouts.
Yeah, it seems insane to me that there wouldn't be, you know, same with the efforts to move away from natural gas. Okay, there hasn't been a concerted effort to look at, okay, what's feasible here? How quickly could we do that? What does the grid look like? Can we support? Like, nobody wants to even have that difficult conversation. They're kind of in this dreamland of what can be, you know, what they would like to do, but absent, like completely disconnected from reality.
Yeah, but while we're vetoing a study of, you know, the impact of data centers, We are spending millions and millions of dollars to assume on studies that assume that the Snake River dams are torn down, which is about 8% of our total electricity generation. So, I mean, it's absurd. There's no, it is very ad hoc. It's based on the politics. It's based on what the political pressures are, not on sort of what's the best vision for how we supply electricity to the people of the state.
But surely, for all those reasons, I mean, there have to be well-intentioned environmentalists on the left who are starting to see that and wake up to that. Are there not?
I think, you know, self-delusion is powerful. I think if you want something, and we see this on the left and the right, people believe, you know, it will work out. And let's face it, we're a wealthy state and a wealthy country. We do a lot of things that are probably bad policies, but we can absorb the costs. And I think that that mindset leads to sort of frivolous decision making, where you can make decisions that frankly don't make a lot of sense and that have a lot of costs. And you can say, oh, but we figured it out in the past. We'll figure it out in the future. And we're doing the right thing. And I think that when you talk with legislators, I get a lot of that. I talked with one legislator who's very smart, university professor, knows what she's talking about. And I asked her about a climate issue. And she says, well, I was just convinced that this is the right thing to do. And I said, well, tell me, like, what convinced you? And we were exchanging messages back and forth. And she just stopped. Because at the end of the day, there wasn't really a convincing argument. There wasn't a tangible argument. It was, she felt it was the right thing to do. And so she was going to do it. And I think a lot of politicians make those sort of moral compromises, assuming that it will all work out.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to all work out for the people who can't afford to see it go down that path. So, Todd Myers, we appreciate your time and your insight as always.
Nice to chat with you.
Todd Myers of the Washington Policy Center, always a wealth of knowledge. I just got to play it one more time, can I? The cut that enraged me into curse-laden beginning of our show yesterday. With Jay Inslee, has the audacity to lie over and over about the CCA raising gas prices, throws this piddly $200 credit at the feet of Washingtonians, hoping it'll bribe them to vote against the initiative to repeal the CCA in November. And then he has the audacity to say this to Chris Daniels at Como News.
Are you trying to bribe voters with this?
No, they're trying to take away $200 from these families. Who wants to take away $200 credit from a family to help them with their costs of these low-income folks? That's reprehensible. You know what else? It's weird.
Yeah, it's us that's reprehensible and weird. We're the ones trying to bankrupt working-class families by telling them that what you're doing is a bribe and you're actually behind the scenes taking much, much more than $200 from them, and the $200 is their own money that they already gave to you in the first place. Get a grip! Get a grip. All right. Oh, you guys, I think we're going to speed past Unbelievable today. It's already one. We've got so much show left. We'll do Unbelievable tomorrow. I promise. I promise. I promise.
It's a good one, by the way.
It's a good one. Yes. So there's a little tease.
There's
so
a tease.
Tomorrow it'll be a fantastic edition of Unbelievable. I've talked about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program. I just feel great. You know, I feel wonderful. I'm down 40 pounds on the program, almost back to my TV weight. Maybe I'll go back to TV. Not. That'll never happen. But, you know, the program worked for me because they just tell you exactly what to do. If you can follow instructions for 60 days, you can lose 20 to 30 pounds on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program in your first 2 months. Because I did, and so many other people who tried the program do. So schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team today at eastsideweightlossclinic.com. That's eastsideweightlossclinic.com. I promise you will be very glad you do. I'm coming up on 2 years since I first gave Eastside a chance in the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, a chance. So I'm super glad that I ended up doing that. Okay, let's get to a little bit of national news. I just have to discuss this. So there was a tweet sent out by a woman named Karen Atia. I'm just going to read the tweet as a setup to the broader story here. She said, I've decided to step down as co-chair from this year's National Association of Black Journalists convention in Chicago. To the journalists interviewing Trump, I wish them the best of luck. For everyone else, I'm looking forward to meeting and reconnecting with you all in the Windy City. So this woman's on social media saying she's stepping down as co-chair of the annual National Association for Black Journalists, which is just what you think it is. It's a group and a conference that's held for black journalists, and they get together and talk about, I guess, black journalist things. And at the national convention, they always invite politicians to come and to do interviews with black journalists. So they invited now Kamala Harris, would have been Joe Biden, but Kamala Harris, and they invited former President Donald Trump. This is something they do routinely at these conventions, especially in election years. So it sounds like Kamala Harris couldn't make it, but Donald Trump accepted the invitation. So Donald Trump is supposed to be, unless something has changed in the last few minutes, being interviewed by three black journalists in Chicago at the National Association of Black Journalists Conference. Some black journalists don't like that very much, and they are now protesting it. And this woman, as she said, Karen Attia, saying she has resigned as co-chair from a journalism convention because journalists at the convention are going to be journalisming by interviewing a former and potential future president of the United States. Wow, if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about the state of journalism in America, I don't know what will. Here's the headline from the Seattle Times. A speaking invitation to Donald Trump splits the most prominent American group for black journalists. Journalism organizations for people of color traditionally invite presidential candidates to address their summer gatherings during election years. But Trump's acceptance of NABJ's invitation has led at least one high-profile group member to step down as co-chair and others to argue that their convention may become a platform for Trump to make false claims or be seen as winning NABJ's endorsement. Wow, let me just start there. It's your job to make sure that it's not a platform for him to make false claims. You're journalists, right? It's a journalism convention. So as with any other politician, like Donald Trump is the only politician who lies, if you're conducting the interview and he lies, isn't your job as journalist just to point out the lies? Are you afraid you can't do your job well? That's literally what journalism is for. And this statement that they don't want him to come because it could be seen as him getting our endorsement. But you always invite politicians during an election year to speak there. Have you ever been concerned or wanted to protest it or boycott it because you thought, oh, they might think, would you be concerned if Kamala Harris came? Would you be sharing the same concern? Oh, people might think we're endorsing Kamala Harris. No, it's just Donald Trump. And you're like losing your mind about Donald Trump. So the debate over NABJ's invite reflects how many journalists are still grappling with how to approach Trump nearly a decade after his first president. What do you mean you're grappling? You cover him fairly, honestly, ask hard questions when he does or says something dumb or wrong, you point it out. Just because you don't like him and like his politics doesn't mean that journalism doesn't operate in the exact same way. He might just require a little more journalisming. Like if you're up to the task, right? It says some group members argued journalists should allow newsmakers to be heard, while others pointed to Trump's demeaning prominent black journalists while president and his frequent attacks on the free press, including labeling reporters the enemy of the people. NABJ President Sarah Glover said the most powerful man in the free world is verbally abusing journalists. His dismissive comments toward journalists April Ryan, Abby Phillip, and Yamichi Alcindor are appalling, irresponsible, and should be denounced. An NABJ member and freelance journalist said, I understand that the job should put us in tough situations if we're doing it in a meaningful way, but this isn't a story assignment or a news conference or a newsroom. NABJ is a place of learning, networking, and feeling supported. It's a space for black folks to feel safe and celebrated, for black media specifically to feel safe and celebrated. So you think that the presence of Donald Trump is inherently like triggering. It is inherently triggering to you. And that you can't feel safe as a journalist if the former president is around or if the former president is being interviewed by your fellow journalists. Let me tell you something. You shouldn't be a journalist then. Anyone complaining that someone like Donald Trump, a newsmaker, is going to be interviewed at a news convention should not be in news, should not be a journalist. Like, this isn't the profession for you. And the fact that, like, this woman stepping down as co-chair thinks that she's doing, like, this righteous thing and doesn't understand how ridiculous she looks and what a stain that is on journalism as a profession is wild to me. Absolutely nuts. It's like, and Harris Faulkner is one of the ones interviewing him. You don't think, like, Harris Faulkner will do a great job. It just is wild to me. You must not have confidence in your ability to interview him. And you're worried he's going to, that he's called him the enemy, he's called journalists the enemy of the people. And he's going to assault them. Okay, well, a good journalist will sit there and press him on it. You've called journalists the enemy of the people. You know, ask him the questions you have about that. You've made these insulting comments about Black journalists, some of whom are in the room today. Why don't you explain the comments that you made about Abby Phillip or whoever it is? Make him do that. That's a wonderful opportunity. If you're so bothered by these things he said about Black journalists in particular, I guarantee those Black journalists will be in the room. So ask the questions of Donald Trump that you want to ask. You have an opportunity to do it, and instead you're backing away and whining and crying. Journalism's not the profession for you. That is crazy, crazy stuff. All right, we're going to get to questions and comments. I will note we don't have a subscriber show poll today because I was busy getting our exclusive out, but I'm going to post one after the show today about our exclusive, so be on the lookout for that. Our friend Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital, we've been talking about him on the show. We talk with him every Thursday about economic news, so we'll do that again tomorrow. But one of the things that Zach and his team at Bulwark Capital really specialize in is managing risk, and I think you have to ask yourself with your retirement portfolio, is there, you know, and how many times in recent memory has your financial advisor not reacted to current events and then not made a change in your investment portfolio? You know, we've got all this global unrest, your consequential election season happening. All of these things matter. Is your advisor monitoring those things? Are they keeping you informed about how they might change your retirement portfolio or outlook? Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. He also hosts the Know Your Risk radio podcast, talks about this stuff all the time. Risk management is their number one focus. They're always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give you as much upside as possible. You only get one retirement, which is exactly why you need Zach Abraham and Bulwark Capital in your corner. Learn about their strategies with their free Common Sense Investing Guide. Sense, like S-C-E-N-T-S. Get it, Nicole? Common Sense. Gotcha. Yeah. You can get that for free. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to KnowYourRiskRadio.com. Okay, let's get to comments on the gender issue in our exclusive report that we launched the show with today. Brian Merkin says, holy. So you can't drink until you're 21, can't join the military or vote until 18, can't drive a motor vehicle until 16, but gender change without parental knowledge is okay at 12. Leadership in this state needs some counseling. So there's only certain things, just to be fair and to be factual. Unless you can be deemed a mature minor at the age of 13, if you can get a medical provider to deem you a mature minor, you can basically do anything without parental consent. So yeah, that would include gender transition surgery. If you can't be deemed a mature minor, then you can't do that without parental consent as a minor. But there are a whole bevy of other things you can do as a minor when it comes to gender transition, like gender hormone therapy, etc., that you don't need parental consent for. So our state has pretty lax laws on that. And it is insane considering, oh, you can't even get a tattoo. That'll permanently mark your body. But you can do all these things that will permanently change the course of your life, all in the name of extreme gender ideology. Leland Taylor, that's what bravery looks like in this upside-down society. Yeah, Tamara Pitsky is absolutely brave. On the beef between Ann Davison and Dow Constantine, Rick Johnson says, I've been very impressed by Ann Davison, the Seattle City Attorney. She stands up to and prosecutes crime. Common sense we seldom see from the Democrats who have largely enabled crime. Observer 777 says, animal cruelty is not a bookable offense. Really? Yeah, that's what Nicole said, too. The animal cruelty one gets me. I mean, you know, a cruelty towards humans is obviously bad, but you can book for assault. But like, you're telling me you can abuse my animal and they're not going to book you in jail?
Yeah,
because that takes a special kind of crazy.
Exactly. And that usually escalates again, like we've been mentioning. If kids aren't punished, it escalates. If adults aren't punished, it escalates.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wild. Like somebody's willing to like randomly attack an animal and you're not like, maybe we should take him off the street for a day.
Right.
Yeah. Hmm. Let me see. On the judge, soft on crime, Greg Olakis, this judge is a danger to society. Baron of Gray Matter with a $5 super chat. Thank you. Send those teens to the judge's house to stay with her so she can turn them around. Great idea.
One of the moms is quoted in one of the articles saying, I think she was in court saying, I do realize I've dropped the ball. So I'm hoping that, because she was petitioning for that whatever program to help them, help her as a mom and be a better mom. And I'm like, well, at least you're admitting it. But like,
drop the ball. You're so way past dropping the ball when your kids are bringing automatic rifles to a parade.
Yeah. Like way past.
And dropped the ball a long time ago.
He got sent home to that person who says, I have a problem with raising a kid.
Man. Captain Cranky Pants, this will never change until they stop blaming the gun and start holding criminals accountable. Mm. Exactly. But I go back to, if it were a white lone gunman who brought a fully automatic weapon to a parade in the Chinatown International District of Seattle, it would be national news. The mayor, the county executive, the governor, Bob Ferguson, they would have all had a press conference. They would have called for more gun control. Now, so compare that. You know that's true, by the way. I know that I'm offering up some scenario that hasn't, you know that that's true. And then you compare it to three black teens, no big deal, a judge saying, well, we won't fix anything by holding them in jail, so just send them on home. People, that's nuts. Inslee in the CCA, Carlene Heath says, now, is this credit only for PSE accounts or for those of us with other utility carriers? I think it's for everyone who qualifies. Well, I don't think it has to be PSE.
So Tommy below says, or talks about a notice that he got. So it sounds like that credit got sent to PUD 3 of Mason County, but then they take fees from it or something. So
let me read it. Tommy T, as a retired and disabled veteran working part-time, I qualified for the $200 working families tax credit. Is this the tax credit? Or are you talking about are you confusing that with the other credit?
I think he's talking about this one. Credit,
but PUD 3 of Mason County got the money, not me. That's an insult of my sensibilities to direct my own expenditures. To make it worse, PUD 3 and other electric providers can't deduct administrative fees from the $200. I'm voting for Dave Reichert. Yeah, it's interesting, Tommy. Maybe explain that a little bit more to us.
Or send us the note.
Right, send us the note, because it's supposed to offset. Like, you might not get a check, right? But it's offsetting your bill. So maybe that's what they're doing. And on future bills, you'll see that offset. So, like, you don't have a balance. You have a positive balance in your
account.
But
I am curious how they're taking it from non-PSE customers. So if you get a notice, send it to us.
Yep. Tammy Thompson, I love the idea to donate the $200 PSE credit to Dave Reichert's campaign. Yeah, and they're not sending you a $200 check, but like that money's going to come off your account. So you're saving $200 that they already took from you. But yeah, maybe you turn around, write a check to Dave Reichert's campaign or any campaign of your choosing. Mm-hmm. On COVID, why COVID?
No, both Matt Gilbert and Bob Larson have COVID, and I just thought we would give them a little shout out.
Nicole puts these little things like to organize the comments by story, and I was like, COVID? Did we talk about COVID today? Matt, and is it Bob Larson?
I believe so.
You guys have COVID? I'm sorry. Oh, man.
Poor guys.
We love you, but hopefully you're not so sick. I mean, it's probably the man COVID is much worse than woman COVID. So you're probably really struggling right now.
It was not fun. If that's what I had, I refuse to test. But if that's what I had a few weeks ago, not fun, but you'll get over it.
Well, I was around you. I didn't get it.
Don't jinx yourself.
I'm healthy as a horse.
Now you can't blame me. We're past blaming me now. So that's good.
Now if I get it. Yeah, it's just me. Sorry, Matt and Bob. That's a bummer.
I know.
That is an uber bummer. All right, before we get to our closing sanity check, a new ad out from the Kamala Harris campaign. Let's see if it's believable. If you're in the market to sell your home, check out our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. You know, the market's a little iffy right now. The interest rates haven't been great, but inventory is low. And that means if you're going to sell your home this year, doing it sooner rather than later can ensure that you're one of the only homes on the market, and that's when you get those bid wars for your property. Here's Wes.
King County, median $1 million. Homes are still selling very, very quickly. If you want to do something this year, give me a call. I'd love to start the process now. I think that things will be moving very swiftly through probably October, and then as the election starts to come up, get closer, people always pump the brakes. But for all of you who are out there that are thinking like, oh, I can't sell my home because I need X amount, you're probably at the peak right now. It's probably worth more than it's ever been than previous times. So what are you waiting for?
What are you waiting for? Visit sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. Start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. And with that, we will segue into our closing sanity check. Just in case you didn't know, Kamala Harris is here to tell you that she, despite not being the border czar, definitely was never in charge of the southern border, she has a better record on the border than Donald Trump.
On the border, the choice is simple. Kamala Harris supports increasing the number of Border Patrol agents. Donald Trump blocked a bill to increase the number of Border Patrol agents. Kamala Harris supports investing in new technology to block fentanyl from entering the country. Donald Trump blocked funding for technology to block fentanyl from entering the country. Kamala Harris supports spending more money to stop human traffickers. Donald Trump blocked money to stop human traffickers. Kamala Harris prosecuted transnational gang members and got them sentenced to prison. Trump is trying to avoid being sentenced to prison. There's two choices in this election. The one who will fix our broken immigration system and the one who's trying to stop her.
Oh, please, America, tell me you're not that dumb. That has been your closing sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you have not signed up to support our show already and get access to exclusive content, including our Sunday show, aptly named Sundays with Subscribers, you can sign up for just $5 a month. At UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. We have three different subscription platforms to fit your preference. We have Patreon, Locals, and X, if you prefer just to subscribe there on X. All right, we'll see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon Pacific Standard Time.